It's Wednesday, March 3rd, and summer is coming earlier than expected. We start here. We need more vaccine doses. Well, President Biden says we've got them.
So many more Americans are going to have access to a vaccine by the end of May.
The new timeline that the White House says will have Americans safe within 3 months. Elections are about votes, which means the election has already started.
The thing that everybody is zeroing in on is how are they going to write the new rule?
The Supreme Court just heard one of the most important cases of the year. We'll walk you through it. And he's in charge of stopping homegrown radicals. Well, he was 0 for 1 in January.
It was unvetted, uncorroborated information.
So how does FBI Director Christopher Wray plan to protect lawmakers in the future? From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. When the FDA authorized the Johnson & Johnson vaccine over the weekend, it made you wonder if this could be the final rounding of the corner in the fight against COVID.
We found out on Sunday night of our shipment of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and it's Tuesday morning at around 10:30, we received the vaccine.
After all, this is one dose. It's not nearly as finicky with temperature. On paper, this vaccine has a slightly lower percentage of effectiveness, but disease doctors will tell you these numbers are just really, really good. The flu vaccine is not nearly this effective. So if everyone takes this, we'd pretty much keep everyone in the country out of the hospital from COVID. So experts are saying this is great. The thing is, they were also saying you won't really see how great it is until the summer.
We were hoping that it would be by the end of April, but what has happened is that the doses that we were expecting earlier from the J&J likely will not be available for another couple of months after that.
You might remember President Biden saying lots of people might not even be able to get their hands on a vaccine until the end of July.
Good afternoon, folks. The Vice President and I have some good news to report.
Well, yesterday, President Biden came out and gave a speech about vaccinations, and for the first time in a long time, his administration is not pushing the timeline back. They're bumping it up. Let's go straight to ABC's Eva Pilgrim, who's actually standing outside one of those so-called mega vaccination sites. Eva, I mean, the president says pretty much anyone can now get a shot by what, like May? What's changed?
Yeah, this is a huge deal, Brad. And what actually changed all of this was that announcement about the historic partnership between Merck and Johnson & Johnson teaming up together to make the Johnson & Johnson vaccine faster.
And today, we're announcing a major step forward. Two of the largest healthcare and pharmaceutical companies in the world that are usually competitors are working together on the vaccine.
That's a deal that the president himself helped to broker, and that is done through the Defense Production Act. Merck is actually going to give two of their production facilities to Johnson & Johnson to be able to make more vaccine.
Johnson & Johnson is also taking additional new actions to safely accelerate vaccine production. Johnson & Johnson's vaccine manufacturing facilities will now begin to operate 24/7.
That means Johnson & Johnson is actually going to have their 100 million doses that they had promised for the end of June. Now they're going to have it by the end of May.
I'm pleased to announce today, as a consequence of the stepped-up process that I've ordered and just outlined, this country will have enough vaccine supply, I'll say it again, for every adult in America by the end of May. By the end of May. That's progress. Important progress.
And that is why so many more Americans are going to have access to a vaccine by the end of May.
Wow, which is just like a huge reimagination of what this summer looks like in this country. What does that mean in our actual communities, though? Like, President Biden says he wants teachers to be able to get the vaccine, like, right now, this month. Who gets it and when?
Well, they're splitting up all of the doses equally to all the different locations. They have said they want to make sure everyone has access to all the different vaccines, no matter if they're in a rural part of the country or in a big city.
We made the appointment because we heard on TV that they started giving the appointments on CVS.
So you're going to see it at your pharmacies. You're going to see it at these mega vaccination sites, at the hospital, at your doctor's offices.
The county has set up a pilot mobile vaccination clinic today. The exciting thing here is that you do not need an appointment. This is all first come, first serve.
We've seen community buses with mobile vaccines. They're going to have them in those as well. So they're trying to make the vaccine easily accessible for people so that people of all walks of life are able to get it. You know, not everyone's able to sit on the computer and hit refresh 1,000 times to get an appointment. They want to make sure that the people who really need to have the vaccine are able to get it.
I do wonder if it kind of creates this dueling narrative, Eva, of, you know, certain places like schools, we're saying should be able to open up ASAP. But then you're also saying, like, don't go opening up everything in your state, because just yesterday we saw several states basically saying, hey, like, clearly we got this on lock. Things are going well. Vaccines are getting put in arms and we're done enforcing these big restrictions.
Well, I think you have to take an honest assessment of the numbers, right? If you look at the numbers, they usually give you a good gauge of what's happening. And what we've seen since the holidays are the numbers have started to come down. They were in pretty much a good decline there for a clip. Those new case numbers ticked up just slightly here in the last week. And that's what's concerning the health officials.
It is now time to open Texas 100%.
We've seen some big announcements from states rolling back the restrictions. So Texas, for one, is opening up businesses completely, all kinds of businesses, restaurants, shops, everything, 100% capacity.
If you want to wear a mask, you're more than welcome to. Are we going to require any of it? Absolutely not. Are we excited? Very excited.
Earlier today, I signed what I expect to be one of my last executive orders regarding COVID-19.
We're also seeing that happening in Mississippi as well. In Michigan, the governor there announcing that they will increase capacity inside businesses, so that will now move up to 50%.
Retail, casinos, gyms, stadiums, and other.
They're also rolling back the restrictions on nursing homes, so people will be able to go visit their loved ones as long as they can present a negative COVID test.
There is light at the end of the tunnel. But we cannot let our guard down now or assure that victory is inevitable. We can't assume that.
And health officials are really urging people to be cautious and careful. As we see some of these states like Texas and Mississippi lifting the mask mandates, especially that's one of those major things that they're concerned about. Those basic things that we can do to prevent the spread of the virus, they really are encouraging people to keep doing them, even if you're not required to do it.
In the meantime, you got more and more of these mega vaccination sites that are doing hundreds, if not thousands, of shots every single day. Some of them going 24 hours a day now if they've got the supply. Supply lines looking much better all of a sudden. Eva Pilgrim, thank you.
Thank you.
The outcome of the 2020 election was clear. In many states, it was also quite close. Multiple states decided by a point or less.
So what do you think? It's exciting to see so many people out. Good to see people so enthused at the beginning of early voting in Georgia.
How long have you been here?
About 45 minutes so far.
45 minutes.
And the pandemic created this environment where in order to vote safely, people needed more options. Mail ballots, early voting were a huge part of this equation.
Drive through and drop it off.
And among voting rights experts, there was this weird glimmer of optimism. They're thinking, yes, it's a deadly pandemic. Yes, it's horrible. But this could actually prompt some changes that we have been pushing for a long time. And if voting goes smoothly, those changes will be here to stay. Well, voting did largely go smoothly, better than expected.
You should want to have an accurate election. And you're a Republican.
We believe that we do have an accurate election.
No, you don't.
That was not the story being told by President Trump.
They rigged an election. They rigged it like they've never rigged an election before. And by the way...
And now, while 30 states made it easier to vote last year, 24 states, predominantly led by Republicans, are actually passing laws right now making it harder to vote. This is a big deal. In some ways, the 2024 election has really begun already. And yesterday, the Supreme Court heard a case that could decide what voting looks like in this country for years. Let's go to ABC senior Washington reporter Devin Dwyer, who was listening in on this hearing. Devin, can you just break this down for me in plain English?
Yeah, so much at stake, Brad, in this case. You know, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was written as sort of this bulwark against racial discrimination in how we cast our ballots. And it took, as you remember, in 2013, a huge blow. The court gutted one of the key provisions there. Well, now it's back before the Supreme Court, sort of the last remaining safeguard in the law against racial discrimination. And the justices, for the first time now, weighing in on this measure, will decide what the test is for deciding when state laws violate that critical part of civil rights law.
We will hear argument this morning in case number 19-1257, Brnovich versus Democratic National Committee.
Fascinating conversation. Over 2 hours, the court debated these issues yesterday. You know, the case comes out of the state of Arizona over two voting rights laws that are on the books there. Democrats say they discriminate against minorities in Arizona. Republicans say they're meant to prevent voter fraud. One of them requires ballots cast out of precinct to be tossed out. The other one bans the practice of third-party ballot collection. Critics call it ballot harvesting, when you give your mail-in ballot or absentee ballot to someone else to turn in. That's a crime in the state of Arizona. And Democrats say this disenfranchises broad swaths of Native Americans, Latinos, African Americans, and rural communities that aren't on postal lines, that rely on these community volunteers to
like
gather
somebody
ballots.
Somebody comes by your place and is like, hey, if you filled out your mail ballot, I'm going in like to town, and I know you don't have a car, so I'll take it into town for you.
Yeah, toss it in the truck. You know, get out the vote in Arizona, where 80% of people in Arizona vote early.
You want to make sure that everyone has confidence in the results, and no one can go around saying that somehow there was some shenanigans or something, or somebody was just.
And yesterday at the Supreme Court, the conservative majority was pretty much in support of those measures.
When a state rule is commonplace in other states, that would seem to be a circumstance that puts a thumb on the scale in the favor of the legitimacy of the state rule. And
they signaled that because dozens of other states have similar provisions, perhaps there was not a discriminatory intent here.
Counsel, you're aware of what the Carter-Baker Commission found about ballot harvesting. They said that absentee ballots are the largest source of potential voter fraud. They said citizens who vote at home, at nursing homes, at the workplace or church are more susceptible.
And Chief Justice John Roberts even signaled in this hearing, Brad, that perhaps there is good reason, legitimate reason, to ban ballot collection by third parties, political operatives, if you will, because there's potential for fraud there. So while there's a good chance that the Supreme Court will let these two Arizona laws stand, the bigger issue and the thing that everybody is zeroing in on is how are they going to write the new rule? How are they going to explain what the test should be? And there, the court was very divided.
If a state sends unsolicited ballot applications to residents of white neighborhoods but not to residents of black neighborhoods, that would amount to giving the latter less opportunity to participate. And
even Amy Coney Barrett, Brad, was skeptical of you know, setting a pretty high bar for proving race discrimination in voting laws. In fact, she said, you know, if a state sent absentee ballots only to white neighborhoods but not to black neighborhoods, that would clearly result in less opportunity for black voters.
If it takes one opportunity away, I guess I still don't understand why that isn't reducing the ability of those voters to vote relative to other white voters that don't share that same burden.
And in some cases, she suggested, you know, the impact of these laws really needs to be looked at.
But, and that's what I want to ask you about, Devin, the impact itself. So if the Supreme Court comes out with a ruling, whenever they're going to come out with it, like that sets the precedent for the rest of the courts around the country and everything. Like, besides Arizona, what are the real world examples of how that ruling could affect how we all vote?
Well, just look no further than Georgia, one of the states that helped decide the presidential race and the control of the Senate.
People protested outside of the state capitol today. They are upset about these proposals to change the way many of us vote.
And we saw just this week the House Republicans in the state of Georgia sending to the Senate there a sweeping restrictive crackdown on voting.
So let's break down the bill that's now headed to Georgia's state Senate. It includes new voter ID requirements for you.
Where drop boxes can go, voting hours on election day, cutting the hours on weekends, requiring voter ID just to get an application to apply for a mail-in ballot.
This is bigger than just us.
We're talking about the people that come after us. For me, it's my three-year-old girl, my three-year-old little girl. It's imperative that I know that you know, when she comes of age, that she can vote without any hindrance.
That will likely land in court if that bill becomes law in the state of Georgia. And as it works its way through the federal court system, it will be held against this soon-to-be-written standard by the U.S. Supreme Court for determining whether or not it passes muster with the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
We could see that as soon as June. In the meantime, we should say there's not necessarily evidence that early voting, mail voting supports one party over the other. However, because of President Trump's rhetoric last year, you could tell that this became the sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. Democrats relied heavily on these. Republicans, not so much. Devin Dwyer in D.C. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, we saw where lies about voting can lead, what the FBI director now plans to do to stop another January 6th after the break.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Did the people who were there tell you why they were there?
We're stopping this steal. According to them, they were doing it for us. They were doing us a favor. According to those terrorists.
You're very precise. You use the word terrorists.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It wasn't just a mob or a bunch of thugs, you know. They were terrorists.
When ABC's Pierre Thomas became the first broadcast reporter to speak to a Capitol Hill police officer following the January 6th attack, you can tell this guy was not given some big heads up about what was coming his way.
But once they started climbing up on the scaffolding and trying to flank us, that's when I was like, all right, guys, this is really, really bad here.
When Congress brought in the people formerly in charge of security there, they said, we should have known more, but the FBI did not send us all their info. Well, yesterday, Congress heard from someone who should know just about every piece of intelligence this country has to offer.
That siege was criminal behavior, plain and simple, and it's behavior that we, the FBI, view as domestic terrorism.
Which is why Congress continually asked FBI Director Christopher Wray, what went wrong on January 6th? Let's go to ABC's Alex Mallon, who covers the Justice Department. Alex, Christopher Wray is a Trump appointee, right? So I guess the first question everyone would have had in that room yesterday was, did the president and his supporters cause this attack?
Yeah, Brad, and Wray was unequivocal. He told senators that there was no evidence
of anarchist violent extremists or people subscribing to Antifa.
And there was no evidence of this, you know, recent theory that's kind of popped up among some Republican lawmakers of the so-called fake Trump supporters.
Based on your investigation so far, do you have any evidence that the Capitol attack was organized by, quote, fake Trump protesters?
We have not seen evidence of that. At this stage, certainly.
Thank you.
So Wray made clear that this was a pro-Trump mob that included white supremacists, white nationalists, you know, militant groups, he said, that came prepared and planned to cause violence at the Capitol that day.
Well, so then what did he know about this attack, or what did the FBI know going into this?
Lawmakers really tried to drill down on that question, but Director Wray didn't really provide much new information about the timeline.
Now to that chilling new report that there was an FBI internal report the day before the siege warning of a violent war at the Capitol.
What we know, Brad, is that there was a report that surfaced in the FBI field office in Norfolk, and that included some specific intelligence related to possible attacks on the U.S. Capitol that day.
One online thread stating, be ready to fight. Congress needs to hear glass breaking, doors being kicked in.
It was unvetted, uncorroborated information, but it was, and it was somewhat aspirational in nature, but it was concerning. It was concerning and was specific enough that our folks in Norfolk thought the need to get it out, even if we hadn't had a chance to corroborate or vet it.
But what we learned yesterday in that hearing is that Wray said he didn't even learn of that intelligence bulletin until days after the Capitol riot.
Is it fair to say, as director of the FBI, you were not informed of the raw intelligence coming from the Norfolk office? Is that correct?
Not before January 6th.
Okay.
But Brent, it's really unclear why the FBI and intel community did not have more intelligence, because what we know now, based on these more than 300 federal charged cases that have come forward in the recent month and a half, there was a lot of intelligence out there of militia groups, militia members.
A federal grand jury has indicted 9 members of the far-right militia, Oath Keepers.
Investigators say a self-described leader of the group wrote on Facebook that President Trump, quote, called us to the Capitol and wants us to make it wild.
Take that house! Take it now!
And Director Ray even concedes that in the days leading up to January 6th, the FBI was going to suspects around the country, knocking on their doors and saying, we know that you're planning to go to to the Capitol on January 6th. Do not go.
Even if we didn't have a basis to charge somebody, it dissuaded a number of those people from traveling.
And so it's hard to square that, you know, contention that there was such limited intelligence communicated to people at the Capitol with the fact that they were, you know, warning people not to come in advance of January 6th.
Well, yeah, and so then it makes me wonder, Alex, like Christopher Wray, sure, he goes up there, he tells these lawmakers what they're asking for. He's going to be the FBI director for, what, the next 6 years, right? Like, that's the plan. This is not something where a president just appoints you and then the next guy comes in. If far-right extremism is this country's biggest terror threat right now, and his FBI failed to stop a huge right-wing extremist attack, I mean, is that a problem for him?
Well, Director Ray claimed in the hearing that he has been the one that's been sounding the alarms over the past 4 years of the Trump administration when we saw this, you know, real rise in domestic terrorism.
We've increased the number of domestic terrorism investigations from around 1,000 or so when I got here to up to about 1,400 at the end of last year to about 2,000 now. That's domestic terrorism overall.
So this rise did happen under his watch. Now, I don't think that any of the lawmakers in yesterday's hearing I heard express any doubt about his ability to lead. You have, you know, the President Biden's nominee for Attorney General Merrick Garland coming in. He's going to partner up with Ray, so it's not going to be, you know, a Trump appointee. I mean, Ray is going to be working in tandem with Garland.
If anything was necessary to refocus our attention on white supremacists, that was the attack on the Capitol.
And, so I think that, you know, while there's always going to be questions among these lawmakers about Ray's capabilities, I think that they are confident in him at this point and are, you know, obviously going to be keeping a close eye on what the Bureau does in tandem with Garland's Justice Department.
Do you agree with Attorney General Barr's statement that there is absolutely no evidence of voter fraud that could have changed the outcome of the 2020 presidential election?
I agree with Attorney General Barr.
And Brad, you were talking in that previous segment about voter fraud and conspiracies around the 2020 election. And I just want to point out that this was the first time that we heard from the FBI director, one of the top law enforcement officials in the country, who was there during Trump's administration. And this was really the first time that he came out and said,
we are not aware of any widespread evidence of voter fraud, much less that would have affected the outcome in the presidential election.
But there's been a lot of criticism of Director Ray about his silence leading up to January 6th and even after the Capitol insurrection, as these conspiracies were swirling and even driving some of the president's supporters to violence.
All right, Alex Mallon covering the Justice Department. Thanks so much, Alex.
Thanks, Brad.
And one last thing. Whenever the phrase cancel culture comes up, one of the next phrases to follow is often, who's next? Who's next to get canceled? Is it Dr. Seuss? Well, as of yesterday, yeah, kind of.
They need to pull it. They need to trash it in a garbage can. This country is not built for that anymore.
It's just a trail of censorship that's ridiculous at this point.
A company says it will no longer allow 6 books by Dr. Seuss to be printed because of racist imagery. But what's different here is it's not some publisher worried about an angry public. No, it's Dr. Seuss's own company who's worried about his legacy.
Why is humor so important? Without humor, we'd have nothing, I don't think.
Theodore Seuss Geisel is dead now, but Dr. Seuss Enterprises is tasked with overseeing his work, protecting his image. And when you look at, say, the book If I Ran a Zoo, the illustrations of men coming from East Asia, the Middle East, and Africa look, I mean, super racist.
There's a character that's described as a Chinese man who eats with sticks.
There was specifically a line that said the helpers
who all wear their eyes at a slant.
Well, yesterday was Read Across America Day, which was created intentionally to land on Dr. Seuss's birthday. Like, that's what a big deal he is to youth literacy.
Do you like green eggs and ham?
And so it was on this day that his company said these six books, quote, portray people in ways that are hurtful and wrong. They say his other books will keep being printed. This isn't over, and it's not just limited to Seuss. Critics have pointed to colonialist themes in Curious George and Babar the Elephant. The American Library Association changed the name of its Lifetime Achievement Award to avoid honoring the author of Little House on the Prairie because of how she portrayed Native Americans. Critics say these books shouldn't be negated just because they're a product of their time. Others say society is just like the children reading. Eventually, we mature. We gain perspective. We change. There's more than change on the line here, too. Dr. Seuss's books still rake in money across the board. Forbes says he is the second highest paid dead celebrity on Earth. The first is Michael Jackson. And don't worry, the truffula trees are safe. Green eggs and ham, apparently still edible. The Grinch is still grinching. And our thanks to our producer Tara's son, Liam, for guiding us through the non-canceled parts of the anthology. We will have more, as always, on our Instagram feed at StartHereABC. You can let us know what you think of all this on Twitter at StartHereABC. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.